McGill Daily of the Daily.
I'm McGill Daily.
Hi, I'm calling from the McGill Daily. Can I ask you some questions?
Is anyone using
this
pizza?
A little bit problematic.
News.
Hey, design. Could I see you for a second?
We're gonna cap this.
News. Can you dummy?
Did that story come in yet?
Editorial's in 5 minutes.
McGill Daily.
Unfit to print.
You are listening to Unfit to Print, a McGill Daily and CKUT news collaboration. I'm Alice Dutrue. Unfit to Print is a student-produced bi-weekly show that brings you the latest in McGill and Montreal news. On today's program, we'll preview some of the events of Rad Sex Week. Rad Sex Week started yesterday, with events lasting until February 5th. It aims to explore sexuality, sexual health, and activism, with workshops on consent, pole dancing, piercing play, and more. More on Rad Sex Week later in the program. We'll also hear a special story on prison divestment, where we'll look at the fledgling prison divestment movement at Columbia University and other schools in the U.S. But first, headlines. Here are some of the headlines of McGill News over the past 2 weeks. A settlement was reached in a case filed against the Student Society of McGill's Legislative Council and Speaker regarding the Palestine Solidarity Motion that was postponed indefinitely at last semester's General Assembly. The petitioners initially sought a new special General Assembly to debate the controversial motion, but eventually agreed to settle in mediation, and no special General Assemblies will be held. As part of the settlement requirements, the Judicial Board will make legislative recommendations to Council regarding adopting special standing rules for General Assembly. The Front d'Action Populaire en Réaménagement Urbain, an organization that fights for housing rights, will set up an occupation camp in downtown Montreal this May. The aim is to increase pressure on the government in response to cuts for funding for social housing. About 140,000 low-income housing units exist in Quebec, with over 40,000 people on waiting lists across the province. However, both the provincial and federal governments have failed to renew expiring government subsidies for social housing in recent years. On January 16th, the Postgraduate Student Society of McGill, aka PGSS, voted to leave the Canadian Federation of Students. In a disaffiliation referendum that came after a 5-year-long legal battle with the Canadian Federation of Students, over 2,000 graduate students cast ballots, more than doubling quorum, less than 3% of whom voted yes to continued membership. Although PGSS will officially be decertified starting June 30th, the two parties remain involved in a separate court case over past membership dues. The McDonald Campus Student Society, MCSS, has begun negotiations with the administration regarding its Memorandum of Agreement, the document that defines the MCSS's legal relationship with the university. The document expires on May 31st. At an open meeting held to discuss changes to the agreement, MCSS executives said that the increases in rent and fees proposed by the administration would severely limit MCSS's ability to continue offering the same services to students it currently does. For more in-depth coverage of these stories or other news articles, go to our website at mcgilldaily.com or pick up a print copy of our paper on stands now. This is Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM. Our first story looks at Queer McGill's 2-week-long event series, Rad Sex Week. The Daily's Anya Sivajothi interviewed Sabine Gruder from Queer McGill.
I am sitting here currently with Sabina Gruder, the resource coordinator for Queer McGill and also one of the organizers for Rad Sex Week. Could you explain to us what the role of Queer McGill is?
Queer McGill was started up a really long time ago as a space for queer-identifying folk and trans-identifying folk to come and basically collaborate with our experiences. It aims to provide a safe space on campus and community. We have weekly games nights and movie nights and ongoing events throughout all of the term.
So Rad Sex Week, hosted by Queer McGill, will be held from January 26th to February 5th. What is Rad Sex Week and what is the purpose of it?
Rad Sex Week is a 2-week-long anti-oppressive movement that aims to bring light to alternative sexual practices and education to them in order to provide resources for the community.
All right. And why is it important to have Rad Sex Week?
It's important to have Rad Sex Week because these resources and education systems can be really hard to access, especially in Quebec where there is no sex education. We aim to be able to have people come to these events and learn things and destigmatize a whole bunch of alternative sexual practices through the workshops.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain to us what some of the workshops are?
The workshops this year are mainly kink-oriented, which was just a coincidence of scheduling. We have workshops around sex and disability. We have a few workshops on consent. There are workshops on technical aspects of BDSM, and then a few more on pole dancing and being healthy with your body through sexual activities.
Okay, all right. What is the intended audience for these workshops and Rad Sex Week in general?
The intended audience is anybody who wants to come. It's not restricted to McGill students by any means. We're trying to make it as accessible as possible by providing whisper translations in French and ASL translation or interpretation for certain events. Most of the events are wheelchair accessible, and we want anyone to come who feels like they're going to gain anything from these workshops. They're really open to everyone.
All right. One of the workshops caused a lot of debate because it was closed to queer people of color, and this resulted in backlash. Why does Queer McGill believe that having closed spaces for queer people of color at McGill is important?
Queer McGill believes that this is a really important space to provide to allow people to feel comfortable in talking about these issues without the presence of issues such as white supremacy or colonization that can sometimes be brought into the room by non-people of color. These discourses and discussions around such have been filled with voices of non-people of color for a really long time, and we feel that it is our responsibility to step back and allow people of color to have these discussions without those presence. It's an issue that comes into equity to allow these spaces to be perfectly comfortable.
Do you believe that McGill provides enough safe spaces and that people understand why there would be a need to have safe spaces?
I feel like there are a lot of spaces on McGill, especially in the RAD, quote-unquote RAD, community organizations, who do provide safer spaces. One of the reasons that we call them safer spaces is because they will never be truly safe. They are never outside of the meta-narratives of oppression or transphobia or homophobia or racism or anything like that. There are some really rad spaces on campus. That being said, there is always room for improvement, and I guess that is why we have so many equity commissions on campus. I feel that people, especially if you come from the background of being oppressed in any way, you might feel more of a need for them. On campus, there is a lot of discussion around recognizing people's privilege and knowing the different type of oppressions that are out there. And I feel that that can really go in two ways. It can either go in a way of people taking this to heart and actively learning the politics surrounding these things to make life safer and equitable for everyone. And then it can go in the other way of trying to defunct these concepts and make fun of them, which is something that we saw a lot on that Facebook thread. So I feel like McGill is having these conversations quite a lot. I feel like there is sort of a divide, and that a consensus and more education could always be out there to make these conversations easier and better and understood by everyone.
Mm-hmm. Could you describe what happened on the Queer McGill page, resulting in the heated debate and the arguments?
What happened was the page started getting trolled, is the official term that people are used. There was one comment which started about 200 long thread around having these closed spaces and the ethics of quote-unquote reverse racism. Some of these comments were very alienating and very triggering to certain people. We ended up having to delete comments and putting out official responses due to some, frankly, hate speech that was put on the page. After that, what happened was our QM coordinator's account got flagged as not being a community organization, acting as a person, just Facebook things, and it ended up taking the event down, which we then had to re-put back up. The threads are no longer on the event, but I have screenshotted pretty much all of them up to the point that I went to sleep, and they're available for anybody who wants to see them.
One of the comments on the events page was questioning who identifies as a person of color, and what does Queer McGill have to say about that?
The specific question, it was probably the one question which was actually very legitimate in the thread. It brought up issues of who can come. How are we going to decide who qualifies as a person of color? And the answer is that we're not going to decide. It is open to anybody who self-identifies as a queer or trans or both person of color. We have absolutely no intention of policing people's race or causing instances of shadism. There will be a little blimp at the beginning of the workshop about how people with different skin tones or darker skin tones might experience slightly different things than those with lighter skin tones. But the honest answer is, if you feel like you identify as a person of color and are queer or trans, and you feel like you're going to get something out of this workshop, you can come. If anybody comes to this workshop with intentional disrespect for the space, regardless of whichever self-identifier they hold, and start to make other people feel uncomfortable and make it a non-safe space, then they will be asked to leave. But that will be by the discretion of the group who decides to go to that workshop.
All right. What were the steps that the Queer McGill coordinators took in responding to this?
It was actually fairly easy. We were doing our anti-oppression and Trans 101 workshops for our new staffers while this happened. So all of the coordinators were actually in the room when we found out. And we basically just drafted up a response pretty quickly and put it out there. We did get the approval of the facilitator before doing so. So by the end of our anti-O training, there was time to put them as quickly as possible.
Do you have any advice or suggestions for people or groups that may receive backlash when trying to have these safer spaces?
I don't have advice for any community organizations. I feel like most of us who are trying to make these spaces safer and who do get backlash understand that backlash happens. One of the things that I found was really great in Queer McGill in responding to this was that our collective was really strong and together in our responses, which was really great to see. As for the people who were commenting against having closed spaces, I feel like there might be a certain lack of understanding the difference between equity and equality. Equity being the understanding that everybody in this world is equal, but that they come from different socioeconomic backgrounds due to processes such as colonization and homophobias and other types of phobias out there. And I feel like people should always be devoting more time and energy to understanding these things and to trying to see it through other people's eyes.
Thank you for that. And as we're coming to a conclusion, is there anything else you'd like to add about Rad Sex Week?
You all should come. Rad Sex Week is really fun. It's super accessible, and it's guaranteed that you will learn some amazing things. To get more information, you can check out our Facebook page. It's just been updated to include the most information we can possibly put on there, and it's recently been translated into French. If you want specific information, you can email me. My email is resource.qm@gmail.com.
All right, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Again, that was an interview with Sabine Gruder from Queer McGill. For more information on Rad Sex Week, check out their Facebook page. Our next story looks at prison divestment movements at Columbia University and other schools in the U.S. who are working to divest university funds from private prison companies and generally push back against the prison industrial complex. The Daily's Molly Korab brings us this story.
The Corrections Corporation of America, also known as CCA, is the king of the private prison industry, an industry that has expanded over 1,664% over the past 20 years, and now houses 130,000 prisoners in the United States. The industry, which is largely unique to the American criminal justice system, has expanded alongside the growing number of prisons and prisoners nationwide, where over 2 million people are now incarcerated. It's an industry that, at its core, pulls a profit from putting people in cages, and doing so in the cheapest way possible. It's also an industry that's supported by some of the unlikeliest actors, like universities. Columbia Prison Divest is a student group that has been fighting their university's investments in the private prison industry, namely CCA and G4S, a British multinational that's been implicated in abuses in its South African prisons. Columbia Prison Divest found out in June 2013 that, as of that date, Columbia University had 230,432 shares in CCA, which comes to a market value of about $8 million. In February 2014, the group sent a letter to Columbia's president, Lee Bollinger, demanding that the university not only divest from its direct holdings in CCA and G4S, but also that university fund managers urge the other companies it is invested in to divest from private prison companies. Since then, the group has been meeting with Columbia's Advisory Committee on Socially Responsible Investing and is hoping that the committee will soon make a recommendation to the Board of Trustees to divest from prison companies. More broadly, the group has been working to educate their community on mass incarceration, organizing in conjunction with local groups like the Coalition Against Gentrification, as well as nationwide organizations like the Responsible Endowments Coalition. The Responsible Endowments Coalition runs campaigns across the country, working with students to fight for university divestment from industries like fossil fuel companies and now the prison industry. There are only a few active university campaigns against private prisons, most visibly at Columbia and the University of California. Here's Ian Truppen, a national organizer with the Responsible Endowments Coalition, speaking a bit to the history of the private prison divestment campaign.
We work with universities on it, and we're also part of a national effort, the National Private Prison Divestment Campaign. And while there have been efforts to shut down or raise a critique of the private prison industry ever since it came into being, the effort that we're part of originated in 2011. And it was spearheaded by the group Enlace. Their main focus is supporting and organizing worker centers in the U.S. and Mexico. And one thing that they were finding is that all the victories that they were having were being undermined by changes in immigration policy in the direction of criminalizing immigration, and particularly for people of color, particularly Black and brown people. And then just looking at this and looking at the political process is becoming more and more apparent in that moment that private prison companies were playing an outsized influence in this, as they had been for some time. And so then it became a particular point to realize that these private prison industries, while they're growing increasingly powerful, most of their investors are actually these large banks and financial firms, which in turn are primarily depend on really people's institutions like universities, pension funds, religious institutions, institutions with endowments that are investing in them in turn. So it really became apparent that money of people who are adversely affected by private prisons and by the policies that they fund, is money from those people is actually being invested directly and indirectly into private prisons to help them continue to cause social harm.
Ian explained the difficulties in trying to discern a university's investment portfolio, especially in comparison to the 1980s, when the well-known South Africa divestment campaign was at its height.
University investments has been becoming increasingly complex. The ties between universities and Wall Street are stronger than ever. And so along with that, actually, the ways in which universities invest has changed. In the 80s, most universities had most of their endowments invested directly in the stock market. So it was relatively easy to see what universities were invested in. And then when calls for divestment came and when organizing shifted political will on campus to divest, it was a relatively simple matter for colleges to pull actually billions of dollars out of these companies because it was directly invested. Now there is a lot less transparency around investments. And I mean, to a large degree, it's a choice. But also it's a choice on the part of universities, but also it's complicated by the fact that universities invest in vehicles like hedge funds, commingled funds, whereby, they're all about maximizing returns, but there's no emphasis whatsoever on transparency.
In particular, he said, private universities are more secretive about their holdings, whereas student organizers in public universities can request information under the Freedom of Information Act, equivalent to access to information laws here in Quebec. One criticism of prison divestment campaigns is the small number of people imprisoned in private facilities relative to the mass incarceration system as a whole. Private prisons make up under 10% of the prison system overall. Here's Maryam Kaba, the director of Project NIA in Chicago, an organization working to end youth incarceration. She also tweets under the handle Prison Culture.
I think when you're talking about prisons, the important thing to understand, and I think, you know, money has a lot to do with what's happening around private prisons, but in the United States, private prisons are about 8% of the total number of prisons. Our prisons are public. Over 90% of our prisoners are in public spaces paid for by taxpayer dollars. And it doesn't mean that those are not places where money is exchanging hands. It is, but it's not a profit-making space. It's actually, you know, prisons are about the economy, yes, and about capitalism, yes, but they are not really hugely profit-making for the most part. And so I think we have to kind of orient ourselves in very different ways when we're trying to think about how prisons operate in our society. You know, prisons are there to confine and to manage redundant populations.
Troopin acknowledged this concern, one that's common among private prison divestment activists. While the private prison industry is a small part of the American system of mass incarceration, it still deserves attention and makes up a small part of a larger movement.
The overall goal of the private prison divestment campaign is not to shut down private prison companies. I mean, that's not the stated campaign goal. I mean, that's the overall goal of people who are working in it, but actually the vision for the campaign itself is actually to undercut and actually to stop private prison companies from co-opting our political process. Because right now they can buy politicians right and left, regardless of what constituents actually think. And this is Democrats, this is Republicans in the United States who are getting campaign contributions from private prisons and then giving private prisons contracts. And so in this campaign, I mean, part of the idea is that by having divestment campaigns that engage people, this can become an issue that, like, the idea of private prisons can become so toxic that politicians can no longer engage in corruption around the prison industry. And so that's kind of a more immediate goal, is shifting the political process. So the target is private prisons, but then also the shadow target is the state itself, which enables them.
It's certain that there are other universities out there with prison divestment campaigns coming their way. It's just up to students and organizers to track down their university's direct and indirect investments in the prison industry and to actively fight the prison industrial complex. Find out more about this movement at columbiaprisondivest.tumblr.com, Enlace International, ENLACEINTL.org, or endowmentethics.org.
Well, that does it for this edition of Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM. Thank you to Anya and Molly for their pieces this week. Make sure to tune in 2 Tuesdays from now to hear our next episode, and check out our past stories, including culture and fiction pieces, at mcgilldaily.com/podcast. Unfit to Print.